It's to the best of our knowledge. Racial segregation in America ended almost 50 years ago. Some say we now live in a post-racial society. But what has integration actually meant for African Americans, now and in years past? I'm Jim Fleming. In this hour, Personal Stories of Integration, we'll talk with Isabel Wilkerson about why the Great Migration is an archetypal American story. NPR's Michelle Norris exposes her father's hidden past, a young man who stopped liking hip-hop, and Toni Morrison on racial change in her lifetime. First, the news. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. It's been almost 50 years since the Civil Rights Movement ended racial segregation in America. As a society, we're more integrated than ever before. But what is integration, or as some might call it, assimilation, meant in the individual lives of African Americans? According to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson, it was only when black Americans migrated north in the mid-20th century that new opportunities opened up, sometimes with amazing results.
John Coltrane, who is considered one of the great jazz musicians of all time and revered all over the world for his work, he migrated at age 17 from North Carolina to Philadelphia, where it was only at that time, only after he'd migrated, that he got his first alto sax.
This hour, personal stories about integration and lessons they have to teach us about race. We'll talk with Isabel Wilkerson about the Great Migration and the people who lived through it. But first, Michelle Norris. She's best known to public radio listeners for the time she was the co-host of NPR's All Things Considered. In 2008, Norris co-moderated a series of award-winning conversations on race and politics. She meant to go on to write a book about this, but she ended up writing a much more personal story. It's called The Grace of Silence. As she told Anne Strangechamps, she wrote the memoir after she uncovered, quite by accident, that her family had a hidden racial past.
I started listening to hidden conversations all over the place, including in my own family. The more I learned about these secrets that my parents sat on because they didn't want to clutter our path, they didn't want to poison our American experience with the pain from their past, I realized that I just couldn't let go of what I was learning, and I changed course.
The big revelation was a secret your father had kept, not only from you and your sisters, but from your mother.
Imagine that you're up in years. You've lived a full life. You've watched your children grow and become productive adults. And imagine that at some point you realize that the man that you had been married to for several years, you'd raised children with, had kept a tremendous secret from you. That he was shot when he was a young man, when he returned to Birmingham, Alabama, after his service in the military. And he never talked about it, never told me, never told my mom. And imagine if you're that woman and you hear from that from your nosy daughter, which is exactly what happened.
What happened? How did you uncover this story in the first place?
Well, I learned about it from an uncle who just blurted it out one day while we were having breakfast. He was upset about young people not voting and that they took things for granted and they didn't realize that, you know, all the sacrifices that had been made years ahead of them. And he just said, well, you know, your father was shot. And he regretted saying it immediately.
Did he try to back
off? Well, he sort of pushed his food away and said, okay, you know, I'll tell you what I know, which was not much. So then I have to go through this sort of anthropological process to go to relatives who I thought may have known. And, you know, calling up people who I knew had this secret and trying to figure out how do I ask these elders to share this with me because they kept it a secret for a reason. Are they trying to honor my father's secret? And I would get one of two reactions. They would either say, oh, God, you know, Mickey, now you know, because my family calls me Mickey. Mm-hmm. And they would have the sense of, you know, heavy-hearted regret. Well, okay, you found out. Cat's out of the bag now. Or they would be really angry at me, and they would treat me like I was an 8-year-old again, and I was asking for, you know, a piece of pie that they weren't ready to give up. I mean, they would just fuss at me like, I can't believe that you're calling me again. Ask me about this. I don't want to talk about this. Don't go looking for this stuff. And of course, I couldn't. The daughter in me couldn't let it go. The journalist in me couldn't let it go. I felt this magnetic pull. And I just had to keep knocking and knocking and knocking on doors until I finally got people to talk to me about it. And then I realized I had to go to Alabama because that's really where the keys to the story were. And in that sense, I got lucky because I found documentation.
But it's like pulling on a ball of yarn.
Yeah.
You know? You just kept pulling and pulling. But clearly, it was a tremendous shock to you.
It was hard for me to swallow this, in part because of the man I knew. My father was a postal worker who raised his kids on the south side of Minneapolis. He was a by-the-book guy. He was very gentle and very kind, you know, the sort of quiet wisdom about him. And he was just, he was very optimistic, and people liked to be in his orbit because of that.
So this really doesn't fit with the picture of a young man who was shot by a white
police
officer.
Well, and it wasn't just that the picture of him being shot. It was what led up to the shooting. My dad returned to Birmingham at a period where the city was full of black veterans who were coming back. And they came back as changed men. And they were met with disappointment and rejection time and time again. And my father, what surprised me so much, given what I knew about him, is that he was on that February evening in 1946 trying to enter a public building, and a policeman tried to stop him, and he stood up to the policeman. He confronted the policeman, which is something I just could not imagine. This is a guy who would, like, fuss at us if we jaywalked. He stood up to this police officer, and a scuffle ensued, and the police officer's gun went off, and that's when he was, when the bullet grazed the side of his leg.
I mean, put that in some context. What does that mean for a young black man to stand up to a police officer?
In the first 6 weeks of 1946, half a dozen returning black veterans were killed by police officers in and around Birmingham. One of them was shot because there was a colored-only sign, and he said, I'm wearing a U.S. military uniform. I don't need to honor that sign. I'm going to move it. And in that case, a scuffle ensued, and he was shot in the head. His name was Timothy Hood. He died. There were cases where they were trying to vote, and if they knew that they were trying to vote, meaning the authorities, they might be visited in the dark of night. I mean, it was throughout the year 1946, this was not limited to Birmingham. Across the country, black veterans were beaten and burned and lynched, castrated, maimed. It was the blinding of a black veteran 3 hours after he was honorably discharged from the Army that so troubled Harry Truman that he appointed the commission that led to the full integration of the armed services. And I tried to talk to veterans who were returning to America at that time to understand what life was like for them. And not all of them that I talked to faced violence, but they did face a certain degree of marginalization when they returned. And they certainly were marginalized in the military because of the strict codes of segregation. And what they describe is this moment where they just decide that their manhood is more important than the strictures that have been forced down their throat all their lives.
And they had lived in the military with a different code and a different sense of who they were and how much respect they were due. And they're supposed to put that down when they come home?
Mm-hmm. So many of them painted a picture that began to make sense to me when I looked at my dad's life. If you had that experience, it would be easy to live the rest of your life as a malcontent, to speak out and sort of live on the fringe of life and just say, forget it. I'm not going to play by anybody's rules anymore. Instead, they took a different course. These men are almost like a social cohort. They tended to follow a very similar path. They decided collectively to live these lives of utter rectitude. I mean, they went the other way. Instead of, like, saying, I'm not going to follow anybody's rules, they followed the rules to the letter. They dressed impeccably. They kept their homes just so. Their cars were always, you know, you could see yourself in the chrome. They made sure that no one could ever complain about them at work.
They became model minorities.
They became model minorities, and they tried to raise model minorities. And they put all their ambitions in their kids and in this belief that they could prove to America that they belonged and that they were worthy of respect. They decided not to pass on their anger because they didn't manifest that anger, but I have to believe that it was there.
Burdens like that can also be inherited. Is there a feeling that you have to prove something to make up for your parents' pain?
Well, I feel that all the time. I feel like I have to prove something to the world in small ways. I mean, that was drummed into me so much, you know, that based on your achievements, the door's going to open a little bit wider for someone who comes behind you. Or maybe that door won't open at all if you don't go out there and rock the world. I mean, they wouldn't use that terminology, but it was always there. I felt that all the time.
Do you think that I feel
that today, and I'm not going to lie to you, I really do. I feel that sometimes when I sit in front of the microphone that I may help some other person of color, some other woman, someone else who, you know, doesn't come from an Ivy League school, you know, who hails from the Midwest, as I do, an opportunity to get in the door and make their own way. That's something that is so deeply ingrained in my DNA that you know, society might change, opportunities might open, you know, for other people a little bit, you know, more broadly, but that is always there. And I don't know that it's a wound. I choose not to see it as a wound. It just is.
What about the long-term impact of stories like this? You track down some older people who were living in Birmingham mm-hmm. at the time, 1946, and I'm thinking about a conversation you had with a woman named Julie Beaton.
Julia's older brother John was with Dad the night he was shot, and she carried so much anger with her. I mean, more anger than I have ever heard expressed by any member of my family. And she told me things I didn't know. She told me stories about my grandparents coming home from a church revival dressed in all white, and a car full of kids, white kids, came careening down the street and they threw rotten tomatoes at them while they were wearing all white clothing, and how, you know, she watched this happen as a kid, and she's so angry about it to this day. She's angry about having to go to the movies and paying for a ticket and then going outside around to the fire escape in the back and walking up to the balcony, you know, to watch a film. She's angry about having to sit in a certain part of the bus or having to step off the sidewalk. I mean, all these things still live inside her. And she talked about, you know, how she doesn't trust white Americans.
Yeah, and she said her grandsons hate white Americans.
Yeah, she did. She did. And I called her back and I said, no, you sure? I know you said this and you know you said this, but this is going to be in print. Are you okay with this? And she said, you know, people need to understand what segregation did to some of us. And I decided to include that in the book for just that reason. You know, anger wasn't manifest in my family in quite that way. That was not the message that I got in my home. And I thought it was important to include it to show the contrast between her experiences and my family's, but also to include it because we talk so much about this honest conversation about race in this country. And if we truly want to have an honest conversation, those are the kinds of things that you might hear.
I was going to ask, is this the kind of conversation about race that you think we need to have?
I don't know if it's the kind that we need to have, but I don't know. I know it's the kind that we might not be able to avoid if we really want to be honest about this. And it's really complicated because imagine if she said that in a studio like this in front of a microphone, how people would react to something like that. Imagine if she said that in the course of a cable television program, your eyes are widening now. I mean, imagine that. It would be blown up and probably repeated because, ooh, this is what happens when people try to talk about race. What I learned in the experience of doing these conversations and what I learned in the course of working on this book is that the conversations can be painful and yet still productive if they are in safe spaces. But, you know, the other reason that I thought this was important is because of the message that she's passed on to her children. And, you know, when we think about race relations in America and we think about the hill we still have to climb, we often think about it in terms of white attitudes about black America, that white America still looks through sort of a shaded lens at black America. But what we don't consider all the time is the message that black Americans pass on to their own kids, too, that their attitudes, that there's a healthy amount of distrust on both sides. And that's a painful but important part of that equation.
Michelle Norris is an NPR host and special correspondent. She's won many awards for her work in journalism, including being named Journalist of the Year in 2009 by the National Association of Black Journalists. Her book is called The Grace of Silence. She spoke with Anne Strangeshamps. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about what racial integration has meant in the lives of African Americans, today and in years past. For some families, integrating also meant suppressing a painful past. For Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson, the past is a story of racial and social change, but one that needed to be retold. In her new book, The Warmth of Other Suns, Wilkerson tells the history of America's Great Migration, which she calls one of the greatest underreported stories of the 20th century. As she told Steve Paulson, the migration of 6 million people from the southern states was nothing less than an epic struggle for freedom.
It was such an oppressive, authoritarian, and totalitarian world that's almost hard for us to conceive of now in 2010. In many courtrooms in the South, there was actually a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on. That is how extreme the notion of mixing was taken to this, to a level that's almost incomprehensible.
There were, of course, far more odious forms of these laws. I mean, for instance, a black person had to wait to be spoken to before...
They had to wait to be spoken to.
Yeah, and then...
They could not reach out to shake the hand of a white person. How many wonderful and amazing interactions and friendships might have occurred between these people, but they were not permitted to experience them because there was fear on all sides of ever breaking this code, because the whites could be ostracized for breaking the code and blacks could face assault and in fact death.
Well, and I mean, to put it bluntly, if a black man looked at a white woman the wrong way or spoke to her, I mean, that could get him killed.
In the decades immediately preceding the Great Migration and the decades immediately following the beginning of the Great Migration into the 1930s, there was a lynching somewhere in the South every 4 days.
Now, one of the people you focus on, you write about, Ida Mae Gladney, was a sharecropper in Mississippi along with her husband.
Yes.
What were they up against as sharecroppers?
Sharecroppers essentially worked for free. They worked for the right to stay on the land that they were farming. Their days were long and hard. Cotton is a very difficult thing to grow. The actual person doing the picking had to extract 7,000 bolls or balls of cotton in order to get 100 pounds of cotton, which was considered the standard for picking in that day. If they were day pickers, they might get 75 cents or a dollar for that hard labor that they would have to do. And as it turned out, Ida Mae Gladney was terrible at it. She could never get 100 pounds. Her husband was constantly having to defend her to the planter that they worked for because the planter was complaining that she wasn't, you know, doing her share. She simply wasn't good at it. I never thought about the idea of someone being good or bad at picking cotton. You just figured it's something that people did. So when the opportunity arose, or actually the circumstances required that they make a decision as to whether they would leave or whether they would stay. In some ways, it was a relief for her because she had not been doing very well at this. And of course, the reason that they left was because a cousin of her husband's had been wrongly accused of stealing something that he had not stolen. The planter and a posse of men abducted him and beat him to within an inch of his life. The thing that he had been accused of stealing turned up the next day, but there were no apologies in order. He was just put in jail. And this woman, Ida Mae Gladney's husband, went to see about his cousin. And when he got back from having seen what had happened to his cousin, he told his wife, "This is the last crop we're making." And they left shortly thereafter for Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. Now, another man you write about, George Starling, had a rebellious streak. He was not happy just working in the fields. And in fact, he spent some time up north in Detroit, worked in a factory, got a taste for higher wages up there, and then came back down to Florida and actually tried to organize other people picking fruit. And this was during World War II, when a lot of men in particular had gone off to fight. And so these southern growers desperately need workers in
absolutely
the field.
Desperately needed what few men there were to and what few people, healthy people, they could get to go out and pick. And so that meant to George Starling that this was, they could see how there was this premium on whatever they were picking. It was clearly indicated in the newspaper that the boxes that they were picking were going for $3 or $4 a box, but they were only getting 12 cents or 14 cents. And he began to organize the pickers and say, well, let's try to get a nickel more a box, because there's a whole lot more that we're putting ourselves up against, and we're not getting paid fairly. The growers absolutely felt that they had to squelch any such activity. That was threatening the very economic system that the growers were dependent upon. It so happened that someone who he had helped forewarned him that he had heard that these people were plotting to lynch him. And when the word got back to George Starling, he decided to leave as soon as he could, and he headed for Harlem.
Now, maybe the biggest surprise to me as I was reading your book was how scared a lot of these people were to leave the South. I mean, literally sneaking off in the middle of the night and not telling anyone or hardly anyone that they were leaving. Why was such secrecy necessary?
The secrecy was necessary because from the very beginning of the Great Migration, there were efforts, massive efforts, to keep it from happening. It began because Northern industry began to recruit African Americans during World War I, when European immigration came to a halt, and they had all these factories and steel mills and foundries that needed workers. And so they looked to the cheapest labor in the country, which was in the South, and African Americans being the cheapest of them all.
So they were actually sending down recruiters to
try to bring people
up to the northern cities.
Absolutely. What the South did was they resurrected these laws that had been used during slavery to keep the people from leaving. They first extracted these huge licensing fees from anyone who wanted to recruit. So a northerner who wanted to recruit someone in the South had to pay $25,000 licensing fee in order to recruit African Americans in the South.
But why couldn't some of these African Americans simply just pick up and leave? I mean, you know, slavery had ended decades before.
There could be any number of reasons why the Southern authorities could claim that a black person could not leave. They were citizens of the United States and should have been able to leave of their own free will. And yet, at the train platforms, when the authorities would see that there were large numbers of African Americans seeking to get on a train heading north, they would begin to arrest these African American passengers wholesale. So they went to great lengths in order to keep this cheap labor from leaving. And so Ida Mae Gladney, who we've mentioned earlier before, her family slowly divested of what little they had. They positioned themselves to move for the day or two before their departure to her mother's cabin, and they did not tell anyone that they were leaving. They only told her mother and one cousin of his, of her husband's. And she said to me years later, "You didn't tell people what you were about to do. You just went and did it because people would talk, and then you wouldn't be able to leave."
Wow.
And that was in 1937 when she left.
Yeah. And you say that the numbers were astounding. I mean, for instance, in a certain period in Chicago alone, 10,000 people were arriving every month.
So the numbers were staggering, particularly during the war years. You know, it ended up being a total of 6 million, and that's a conservative estimate because it really can't truly be known how many left. What you can see now is that the majority of African Americans that you meet in the North, the Midwest, and the West are, for the most part, descended from people who were part of this great migration. So it's massive to think about the effect that this migration had on the demographics of this country. They were forced into small islands that are now known as ghettos in these cities. Every city in the United States, in the North and the West, had some pocket that where they were limited in terms of where they could live. They were doubled up and tripled up in these cold water flats. And many of them, it was so crowded in some of these northern cities that there was actually there were actually workers who rotated the use of a bed. So they were limited into where they could live.
And part of the reason why they were limited was there were all kinds of rules that the white neighborhoods set up to try to prevent black families from
moving
in. Yes,
there were restrictive covenants that were put in force in order to keep whites who might have wanted to sell even from doing so, even if they had the inclination to do so. So there was tremendous pushback and hostility and violence even that attended them whenever or greeted them whenever they attempted to break beyond the bounds of the ghettos that they were limited to.
Now, to some degree, you are telling a story about the end of segregation in America. To what extent is this also a story of assimilation?
In my view, the Great Migration is the actual fulfillment of the Emancipation Proclamation, which came after the end of the Civil War, toward the end of the Civil War, and was intended to free and bring African Americans into the mainstream of American life.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, it was about the mainstreaming of African Americans into American citizenship.
So in some ways, this is an immigrant story. I mean, similar to the Italians or the Mexicans who moved to the United States. But in this case, they were already in the United States.
They were already here, so they should not have had to have done that in order to experience the fruits of being an American. But that is exactly what they had to do. And that's the reason why I make such a comparison between that and the immigrant experience. I did so much reading about the migrant heart, the immigrant heart, the yearning and the desire for someplace better. And I really, truly see so much that these people had in common with the people who came across the Atlantic in steerage in hopes of a better life. We have so much more in common than we've been led to believe.
Now, one of the assumptions that a lot of people have made, including a lot of scholars, is that these black people who moved up to the north and into various northern cities were mostly illiterate and uneducated and brought with them what Daniel Patrick Moynihan once called a tangle of pathology. You say this is not remotely the case.
Well, the data do not support that. The data show that these people who participated in this great migration, the 6 million people who came up from the South to all these other points, North and West, they actually were better educated than those that they left behind. They were more likely to be married than the people that they met in the North, meaning the African Americans that they met in the North. And they were more likely to be raising their children in two-parent households than those that they met in the North. They also were more likely, oddly enough, to be making more money than those in the North, not because they were being paid more per hour for their work, but they were working longer hours because they had come from a culture, a caste system, in which they were accustomed to having to work for such long hours for so little pay. And then ultimately, with any immigration experience, it's often judged by what happens to the succeeding generations, too. And the succeeding generations, the picture is mixed. However, one of the great legacies of the Great Migration is that it gave an opportunity for many, many people who are now well-known household names to realize their full potential as Americans in this country. And one great example is Toni Morrison, the Nobel laureate, whose parents migrated from Alabama to Ohio. Their daughter, Toni Morrison, would never have been able to get the chance to read as many books as she later would, because in the South, it was not legal for black people to go into a library and take out a library book, something as basic as that. How do you become a writer? How do you become a great writer if you don't get a chance to read books? And her parents' migration to Ohio allowed her to be able to go to better schools and to have access to books, which clearly would have had an impact on her ability to become a writer. The same goes for such people as the playwright August Wilson and Lorraine Hansberry and so many other people who have become famous in literature. Ralph Ellison was part of the Great Migration. Richard Wright, the great bard of the Great Migration, had the opportunity or took the opportunity to leave the South. And this is just a small example of the kind of creativity that had the opportunity to flourish because these people's parents decided to migrate.
Isabel Wilkerson teaches journalism at Boston University. In 1994, she won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing as Chicago bureau chief of the New York Times. Wilkerson's own parents were part of the Great Migration. She talked with Steve Paulson about her book, The Warmth of Other Suns. Nobel laureate Toni Morrison vividly recalls her childhood in Ohio. It was dramatically different from the experiences of her parents in the segregated South. Morrison says racial integration improved people's everyday lives, but it had the unintended effect of magnifying class differences among African Americans.
It created them. Created them because now you don't have to live in those neighborhoods anymore. You don't have to go to those black-owned businesses. You don't have to go to the black lawyers, the black doctors. You don't have to go to those powerful, excellent black schools. You can go anywhere. So those institutions that were dependent in an apartheid situation on the black clientele or patients or students or what have you, many of them failed. And it was interesting to me that one of the cries of the civil rights movement toward its latter part was black nationalism, which meant a kind of separatism. Support our own businesses, our own neighborhoods, et cetera, which was precisely what the situation was prior to civil rights. All I'm saying is the progress of acquiring full citizenship has a cost.
I'm curious about your background and the role that it plays in your work. You grew up in Lorain, Ohio. I suppose you would call that the heartland of America. And,
we used to. I think the heart moved in the last few decades.
How much did that particular place shape your writing?
Oh, a lot, I'm sure. It was a small town. It was working class town. One library, one high school, etc. A very, very mixed town. I never really knew, still don't, what it really means to live in an all-black neighborhood. We were just all poor. And I never went to the black schools. I never, you know, participated in that particular kind of experience that seems to be, at least in the public mind, typical of African-American existence. It wasn't for me. And also the incidents of racism to me as a kid or as a teenager were irrelevant. I just thought, you know, this has nothing to do with me. And I'm not going to spend a lot of energy on it. It was not the all-consuming thing for me. But what was consuming were the relationships among us and how history or the society formed us.
Do you think you had different kinds of relationships growing up in that particular environment? I mean, relatively integrated but poor?
Yeah, I think so. I was stunned to see, for instance, the whole press toward busing. It had some logic, but it seemed a little ridiculous to me on the face of it. Switching schools. You know, I've been sitting in schools with white kids all my life. Some were brilliant, some were thugs. Nothing improved because of that. Nothing academic, I mean. But what you get if you grow up that way with other races, Mexicans were there, and East Europeans were there, and tons of Italians, and what we call Czechoslovakians. All those people were there, and you live with them in that town, on that street, they were right next door. So I didn't have any awe, racial awe. You know, you just get rid of it at an early age. Then later on, when you're an adult, you find out, oh, there's something else going on here. So that moving to Washington and seeing signs in the buses that said, colored only, for me, now I don't want to make this too glib, but it was kind of a hoot. I would steal those signs. It's kind of little things. We would take them home and put them on the bookcase. Now, mind you, for my parents, there was nothing funny about it at all because they were born in the turn of the century South, Alabama and Georgia. And their whole lives were trying to protect themselves from evil or marauding or violent white people. Theirs was different.
Toni Morrison has won many awards for her writing, including the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the Nobel Prize in Literature. Her acclaimed novels include Sula, Song of Solomon, Tar Baby, Beloved, and Love. Her ninth novel, A Mercy, was published in 2008. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In Madison, Wisconsin, a small group of African-American women meets once a month to play cards. They call themselves the Bid Whist Ladies. When their group began more than 25 years ago, most of them had small children. Now, those kids are grown, and the Bid Whist Ladies are still playing cards. Bid Whist has been a staple of African-American culture for generations.
Darlene Pierre-Moss. I've been a part of the group over 25 years. A group of ladies, African-American ladies, getting together playing cards. First started out on a Wednesday night at 6 o'clock.
I'm Jackie Hunt, one of the Bid Whist ladies. I grew up in Chicago. I got my Bid Whist education in the bathrooms at Little Bloom Technical High School. My parents played Bid Whist on Sunday afternoons for family gatherings, and so when I found this circle of women that play cards, I was like, okay, this is what's up, home.
Uh-oh. I'm looking at you. Okay, we got three.
I got those stress. I said, quick.
Okay, quick. Don't come back here.
A lot of people say it's similar to euchre, but I never played euchre, so I really don't know. I played spades and pity pack and tonk growing up. So in college, spades is a pretty popular game, and Bid Whist is very similar to spades, where you bid the number that you think you're going to be able to get, and the object of the game is to actually get that number or more.
Mona Adams Winston. I've played in games, not with these ladies, but, you know, at people's homes or different places where people were, like, out for blood. You know, people question, you know, how did you win? How did you win that? You know, you're playing unconventionally and da-da-da-da. And I'm like, you know, I won, get up, let the next people sit down. But here I never feel that. I always feel like, you know, this just makes my heart feel warm to know that I'm going to come and see everybody and get my yell on and get my cheer on. When you go to Boston, that means you get all the books. That means that you won the whole game. Nobody got anything in there, you got it all. I'm looking at her raking the cards, and I'm like, oh, we won that. Anyway.
Oh, my gosh.
The hostess always typically provides the main dish, and then we all bring stuff. Sister Kathy always brings deviled eggs. Don brings corn pudding. Jackie Colbert, she brings 7-Up cake. It involves food, fellowship, and playing Bid Whist.
You know, it's like growing up sitting at the kitchen table and people coming in and sitting down and talking for hours. It's like our kitchen table.
It really wouldn't matter if, you know, if a white person wanted, you know, to join the group, but I think they don't play Bid Whist, so. I think they play bridge.
The Bid Whist Ladies of Madison, Wisconsin. Producer Cynthia Woodland prepared that piece. Hip-hop was once the unique expression of urban black culture. In the last few decades, it's gone mainstream, though for many young African Americans, the music is still a powerful source of cultural pride. Thomas Chatterton Williams grew up listening to hip-hop. His scholarly father also instilled in him a passion for reading books. But it wasn't until he went off to college that hip-hop began to lose its appeal. Williams tells the story in his book, Losing My Cool.
What appealed to me about it mostly was the sense of identity that it gives you. The same way that, you know, being good at sports, when you're black, it makes you feel like here's something that is for you and that is kind of your birthright. When you're growing up black in this country, unfortunately, still going to Harvard, writing a novel, studying philosophy, painting beautifully, those are not things that are considered by whites or blacks to be your birthright.
And it's important to you to be black. I mean, your mother is white, your father is black, but you're very clear that your family always said that doesn't matter. You are black and you need to understand that you're black.
That's right. And that's because my parents believed, and I still believe this is true, even though things have changed a lot from the early 80s when I was born. But my parents essentially believed that there's no such thing as being half white or having half of a privilege. You're either white or you're not. And so I clearly wasn't. Though I am mixed, I have mixed race heritage. I'm a black man like any other, like W.E.B. Du Bois, Frederick Douglass, Malcolm X clearly had a lot of things going on in his DNA. It's kind of always been part of the black American experience to not be completely genetically from Africa, but you're part of a black culture, and you're basically accepted that way by other blacks.
So how does hip-hop culture deal with that? Does it care?
I think that hip-hop culture does care about being black, but not about the purity of your blood. I think it cares about the way you conduct yourself. And so if you keep it real, if you're authentically black, it's the way of behaving. If you even look at some white rappers, there are white rappers who are accepted essentially as real because they buy into a way of acting and behaving that fits in with what is considered black. Sort of pounce, just crush him and beat him to the ground. I just sold 2 million records, I don't need to go to jail. I'm not about to lose my freedom over no female. I need to slow down, try to get my feet on solid ground. So for now... I actually grew up in a different way than most of my peers did. In my house, I had to study. My father, black man, born in 1937 in the segregated South, insisted that I study and do well in intellectual endeavors. And outside, in the basketball courts where I spent most of my time and at school, the black world that I kind of moved through and felt comfortable in demanded very different things than that, and also implicitly demanded that I hide those bookish aspects of myself, the more intellectually curious aspects of myself.
Yeah, you grew up reading the autobiography of Malcolm X at the age of 7, and as an older youth, reading Shirley Jackson's The Lottery and discussing how real that was. But it also gave you a kind of literary sense to take to the music, I would think. And hip-hop is nothing if not pretty descriptive.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, I don't criticize hip-hop from an artistic perspective because, as you say, it is descriptive. There's a lot of artistry to it. But sometimes if you take a look inside of what is actually the content, what's the message, what are the ideas that inform the art and the music, it's quite astounding sometimes what is being described so eloquently.
Do you remember some of the things you were listening to, who you were listening to?
Oh, absolutely. I was born in 81, so I guess the earliest that I was really paying attention to it was 89, 90. So that's when the West Coast was really starting to influence the music, and the kind of the subject matter was becoming darker because L.A. had a lot of gang culture and prison culture that was coming into the music. If cocking all the riches, got the hollow points for the snitches, so won't you just walk on by, because I'm too hard to lift, and know this ain't Aerosmith, it's the money over D.R.E. from the CPT, on a robbing spree, a straight G. Dr. Dre's The Chronic was a very big album in the early 90s that kind of influenced me because on the one hand the music was extremely mellifluous and seductive. On the other hand, it was kind of astounding to me because it was so explicitly violent and misogynist, and I kind of bought into these ideas about women and about how to respond to, you know, perceived slights and disrespect.
So during the day, you'd behave in ways that if you had done that at home would have been, well, frowned upon?
I always had a sense that there was something about it that was not quite okay. But my father understood intuitively that I was under a certain degree of pressure, and my brother was too, to fit in. And he kind of regretted that we were in a cultural environment in the first place where we would have to fit in to these things that he considered not so great. But we did have to fit in, and so he wielded a light hand. If we were doing things well in school, if we were behaving properly, if we weren't getting into trouble, he wasn't going to give us too much grief about what we were listening to and how we were dressing. It was kind of a tacit agreement we had.
It's a relationship that clearly must have made you feel secure, even when you were listening to music that suggested you wanted to be somebody different from who he was.
I felt secure, and I felt that very privileged to have the father that I did. But when I thought of being black, I thought of my father as somewhat of an anomaly. He certainly was not someone who struck me as a sellout, but he struck me as perhaps eccentric because I just found him to be exceptional and didn't think that that was necessarily a way for me to be black. The older I've gotten, I realize that the black experience is much more varied and multifaceted than I realized in my small part of New Jersey growing up. But growing up, I felt that to be black, I had to look more like what was outside of my house than what was inside of my house, because the kids that I was around, they really didn't seem to be too interested in various ideas about blackness.
Well, you talk about being out on the playground, and I've forgotten the name of the other kid, Rashawn. Who
older kid, yeah.
Yeah, who was a great basketball player, and you really admired him.
Well, that's true. I mean, the center of my life growing up was basketball, really. And this guy, he was kind of, when he would come around, he was always the best on the court. And he was extremely nice to me. He basically looked like everything that I had ever seen on BET and hoped to grow into. He had tons of sneakers. He was well-dressed. He was cool. And he was tough. Nobody wanted to disrespect him, which looks powerful to you when you're a child. And I was about 10 years old, and I remember he got in a dispute on the basketball court with a white kid who was much bigger than him. And he just really, in about 20 seconds, he knocked the kid unconscious. And I remember being kind of horrified about it, but also kind of proud of him, because I had experienced by that point a few instances of racism. And I thought, there's a kind of power that Rashawn has that I wish I had.
And some of that is reinforced by the music, too, isn't it? The music that is so clear about how you establish who you are and how tough you have to be.
I mean, it's at the level now as an adult. I can tell it's a lot of these guys are acting. But there is reality to it. I mean, people are valuing toughness and physical prowess over the development of their minds and spirits. And you know, and knocking somebody out over, you know, a minor argument, I think that that's... That's quite frankly ridiculous. And, you know, if you listen to the music nowadays, it's so hyper-violent, it's unbelievable. Actors and minstrels like Rick Ross or Young Jeezy, it's this kind of casual reinforcement of it being okay and cool that I think does actually have an effect on young people growing up. Hit the kitchen lights, now it's marble floors everywhere. Call the carpenter, the roof on the coop's gone. Give up what he sold on the truth, homes. Kitchen fumed up, jamming Tupac. Get my Benny Honda zone, working two pots. Baby need shoes, partner need bail money. Bloodhound for the bread, I just smell money. Just right, I recollect. Hands on Jesus, really counted them checks. I'm Donald Trump in a white tee and white ones. The conversation is money, you won't say. And it cares so much. You talked also about being in school, and most of the kids you were with wouldn't know when Martin Luther King's Day was, but they would know when... When Biggie Smalls was assassinated. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think that's... It's unbelievable. You know, first of all, that we consider that to be an assassination. And second of all, it's unbelievable that that's a realer date in our minds than, you know, things that really mattered and actually had historical impact.
We come back to your father and basketball. He came to a basketball camp where you were performing. You were scared. You were nervous. But what he said to you seems to me a sort of example of the two halves of your life, that your world doesn't need another entertainer or an athlete.
Oh, yeah. When he first said it to me, I was surprised. Why not? You know, my idea of pure success would be to, you know, play in the NBA. And it didn't make sense to me then. You know, why wouldn't he want another black entertainer? That's great. Everybody wants to be an entertainer or an athlete. But I thought about it, and he would say it to me over and over and over again. And I think it was really in college when it started to really hit me as some of the best advice I think a black father can give a black son, even if that son, or, you know, a black daughter too, even if that child does grow up to be the next Beyonce or the next Kobe Bryant, that's fine. But that shouldn't be the sole emphasis. You know, it's fine if it happens, but it's equally fine if they become a scholar or, you know, or just a decent civilian.
So when did these worlds begin to really collide, to conflict?
The worlds really started to collide when college was approaching. I think that during my freshman year, I looked at myself and I started to seem ridiculous to myself. I felt I was living in a kind of a bad faith. I was trying to be something that I wasn't and oughtn't be.
In the book, you talk about being in the car one day and listening to, almost nostalgically, to songs you liked. You remembered liking mm-hmm. so much that you'd play them over and over again. And then feeling as though you really didn't want to be a part of that, but you couldn't talk about it to anybody, and nobody else would understand.
Right. Well, there are kind of these things you're not allowed to say. You're not allowed to criticize a person like Jay-Z because, you know, a lot of people are proud of the huge success he is in certain ways. He's a huge financial success. He's really a big name. He makes good music. So you're not allowed to criticize the fact that he, you know, essentially endorses selling drugs and makes that seem cool to a population that is disproportionately hurt and affected by the drug trade. We do dirt like worms, produce G's like sperm, to legs spread like germs. I got extensive holes with expensive clothes, and I sip fine wines and spit Ventus flows, but you don't know. I had just come back from France with the kind of the fervor and zeal of a convert. I had just only started to know anything about wine. And I said, I bet Jay-Z couldn't possibly know about fine wines or, you know, really understand the subtleties of viticulture. And my friend got, you know, it was a stupid joke, insult, but my friend got offended as though I had talked about his uncle or something like that, you know, and said, why couldn't Jay-Z? Well, you have to go to Georgetown to be able to do those things or to know that. And it was the first time I realized you're not allowed to poke fun at or to criticize seriously, you know, these things that we're supposed to revere.
There's something in the culture that you buy into and you have to buy out of at some point.
There's a mistaken idea that you're leaving your blackness behind if you criticize even guys like Gucci Mane or Rick Ross. There's a kind of idea that you can't completely leave that part behind because otherwise you're selling out somehow. So even President Obama says he listens to Jay-Z and Lil Wayne on his iPod. I recently wrote a piece criticizing that, and I've never written something that seemed to make so many people so angry.
Can you imagine your father ever listening to hip-hop?
I can't. You know, he's just, I think, too old to be influenced by. The music doesn't sound like what music to people in that age range expect music to sound like. And the idea is, I mean, he would tell you that there's always been an element of kind of some of the stuff I'm criticizing in black culture and in American culture at large. But what he would say is so much worse now is, it's what I'm saying too, that this has narrowed to the point where it's not just a way of being, it's the way of being. It's the way of expressing your blackness. Black street culture has overtaken the whole category of black culture.
Of course, I can imagine that you might, if you're far away from your family, sit down in a room and hear somebody playing a little Coltrane, and it would bring your dad into the room too.
Oh, yeah. Whenever I go home, now my mother knows that I'm very into jazz for the past few years, so whenever I go home, my mother will actually put on this collection of Coltrane that she has, and my father and I might be playing chess, and that's really the music that's on in the house now in my adult life.
Thomas Chatterton Williams is a writer. His book is called Losing My Cool: How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website, ttbook.org, where you can stream audio or download a podcast. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Integration Stories, program number 1114A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Aaron Kloon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.